And you're very welcome back to Lifeline. Now I should be joined on the line by Nina. Good morning, Shanina.
Hi there. How's things, Debbie?
Not too bad. Tell us your story.
Debbie, I suppose my role as a carer, I had a career and I didn't choose to be a parental carer, and I don't think many parental carers choose to be. We end up in these roles. And but I suppose my journey as a carer probably starts back to before when I decided I want to have a child. I was working. I was single. Didn't have a partner, obviously, and I wanted to have a child so much that I went down the IVF route. And after many years and many rounds, I found out I was pregnant. So that was the most amazing news. As I said before, it felt like winning the lotto. And then I went off down this path. Obviously, my pregnancy. But halfway through my pregnancy, I found out that there was a problem. There was a problem with my son's heart. And after many, many weeks throughout the pregnancy, very upsetting weeks, finding out that it wasn't just his heart, there was seemed to be many issues going on. And it was probably later in the pregnancy, about 33, 34 weeks, I was told that there was a genetic issue.
Well, yeah. Nina, I'm not cutting in. I'm just thinking you've went through a few rounds of IVF, which is hard enough and stressful enough, and then eventually you got pregnant, and then the happiest time of your life, and then to be told there was a problem. At the beginning, you thought, okay, I can deal with if this is something not too serious. But then, as the weeks went on, so what exactly? How many weeks were you when you were told there was a genetic problem?
Probably 33 weeks. Okay. Now, there had been so many. Oh, I was under the fetal assessment unit in Hollis Street. I had had many scans at that stage, and they were all quite puzzled. I think it was hoped that it could be just something simple that could be sorted, if that makes sense. Probably, you know, we knew there was a problem with my son's heart. I thought it could be some simple surgery. But then as all these things started to mount over the weeks, it was only then at that stage, 33 weeks, they said, there's too much going on here. We do believe it's something genetic. So my pregnancy from 20 weeks wasn't pleasant. It was actually quite upsetting. And obviously I was alone, and you know, it was actually quite traumatic. And then leading up to the day that my son was born, it was planned section that I had, because he was so small. There was a big concern and fear that what might happen if I had to deliver him naturally. And in the theatre, I recall there were so many people there. I was already pre-warned that he would go off to ICU. And when my son was born, he took one breath and stopped breathing. And then my first view of him was of being resuscitated on a little table close by with many nurses and doctors there, and then he was gone straight to ICU. So that was probably my first view of my son. But being honest, it probably wasn't a shock, because I was quite prepared that he would be gone to ICU. And I suppose that was the start of my job as a carer.
So you, when Jack came into the world, that was you seen him for a minute, and then he was taken away from you. So you weren't even really able to bond with him.
I saw him that night. I think I was brought down at around midnight to see him in ICU. But I was, you know, obviously on various pain medication and drugs that I vaguely remember the moment. And he spent the next 4 weeks then in the NICU unit in Hollis Street. And so as you can imagine, it was very hard to bond with a child that you probably, you know, it's you know, you can't just relax. You're surrounded by all these machines and, you know, other nurses and people. It was so difficult. So that next month, I still didn't know what was wrong with them. I was just praying that they would tell me that everything is okay, your son is normal. Which did happen actually after 4 weeks, ironically, and then I skipped out of the hospital thinking, okay, we've just had a rough start, things are now going to take off now.
Okay, so Nina, when you were leaving the hospital at 4 weeks, were you told like there is probably something wrong, but it's not as, you know, as I suppose serious as you thought it was going to be? So at 4 weeks you were bringing him home thinking this is going to be okay.
I knew he had a heart complaint, and I think the cardiologist was just relieved that it wasn't as serious as was once thought. But he did need heart surgery, so I said, that's okay, we can deal with that. Obviously, he was very tiny. When he was born, he was actually full term, but he was 4.6 pounds. So it was very tiny for, you know, full-term baby. So the focus was on really just, and I just, he was a bit, wasn't doing much, didn't have normal reactions that a typical newborn would, but I was a first-time parent. I had really no clue on how he should react.
Yeah.
So I sort of sailed along thinking that he's just a little bit delayed. He'll get going.
And was he drinking his bottles okay? And like,
Yeah, this is the thing. Oh. He was drinking bottles because before we left Holles Street, he was on an NG tube, which is to feed him, which is the tube that went into his nose to feed him. And he was off that before he was, you know, that was off before we left. And he was on bottles, but he struggled with the bottles. This was the problem. He struggled so much with bottles, and he seemed to be crying a lot. And I know there were people that said, oh, reflux and colic and all these terms. So I was changing formulas. But, you know, the poor child was probably in so much pain. That's what I think. And it's only after about 10 weeks, he was in Holles Street for 4 weeks, came home for about possibly 5 or 6. And then the public health nurse, Christine, who was absolutely amazing, she was always around and always helped me and give me guidance. And she said, no, Nina, this is not normal. He's not putting on weight. I think at 10 weeks, he was still only 10 pounds. Like newborn babies are heavier than that. So she made a call to Temple Street. We went in. I thought it was just probably for a night or two. They put him back on this NG tube to feed him. I thought, oh, great, 2 more days of this and we'll be home. We were there for a month. And the doctor that we were under there, she was absolutely amazing. She must have had every single department, but it felt like that, in the hospital involved in examining him and looking at him, because I think she knew that he didn't have the normal reflexes or do what your typical newborn does. So, so that was another month in Temple Street. But unfortunately, when we came home with that tube, that feeding tube, okay, which is still there to this day. And because the more, they were trying to get his weight up, so the more of the feeding tube, you know, he got, he just stopped taking his bottles. So we had a brief few weeks on bottles and that was it. So my son has been tube fed ever since. And then we came home from Temple Street that time, and it was all of a sudden, that's when I really felt terrified, frightened. I hardly left the house at first. My son was getting feeds every 3 hours, like a newborn, but they were through a tube which comes attached to the feeding pump. And I had all this equipment and tubes and syringes. And so my life had gone overnight from being a first-time mother to what felt like a nurse that was never trained in this role. Obviously, the hospital gave me some training, but the fear, and you're alone doing all this, it wasn't exactly the first few months I thought I would have with my son.
Well, Nina, as you know, a first-time mother, as it is scary enough, and trying to get used to adapting to being a mother, and then to be on your own as well is quite scary. But then to have this on top, like, who care? You're a full-time carer, so who cares for the carer? That's when, you know, things get on top of you, and then, you know, you're looking after your son full-time. It must have been so hard on you.
Do you know, the first year, I can honestly say, was a blur. I don't really remember much. And it was, I've often said to people, do you know, it's like a roller coaster. You think you're doing really well, and then you say, take a sudden dip in the road. It could be a negative appointment you've had. It could be, like, it was constant ups and downs, and you think you're doing great, and then you have hit another wall. As someone described to me recently, being a parent to a child with special needs, it's like being at a traffic light. You look left and right, and then you're hit by an aeroplane. And it is like that. You're dealing with feelings of sadness, grief, you know, that you don't have the child that you thought you would have. And as I've said many times, it is a 24/7 job, even now, 5 years later.
Mm.
People say, well, the first year of the child, of course they don't really sleep much. 5 years later, my son, he's tube fed at night, so I still have a baby monitor beside my bed. The alarm on his machine could go off some nights, sometimes a couple of times through the night. It's almost like you constantly have one eye open. You're always ready to jump up, ready to run.
Yeah.
You don't... I couldn't, here in the house by myself, I couldn't relax and have a drink, a glass of wine, because you don't know, what if something happens during the night, I have to bring him to Temple Street. You have to constantly be in that constant state of flight mode, almost, where you're just constantly switched on and catching sleep in between all the things that might happen.
And even the sleep you're getting isn't proper, you know, deep sleep.
No,
because, as you said, you're always on alert.
Constantly, always on alert.
Yeah.
And as I've said to many people, having a child with special needs, this isn't just for a year or 2 years, which most parents would experience. It's forever. I don't know, you know, it's forever. And there is no really breakaway from this. As I said, I've got amazing support over the years from the likes of Jack and Jill Foundation. But, you know, what I've been said to you many times is that it's actually proper respite, as in out-of-house respite,
yeah,
for me just to be able to get out, get away for a night.
Mm.
And but last year is just an example of what can happen to carers if you don't get a break. And I appreciate it was a pandemic. I appreciate I didn't have my usual support of family, friends, my son, Jack and Jill nurses with me. And as a result of that night and day constant where my son, at the time, his sleeping pattern was so bad, I literally had, I hit a brick wall. I had physical collapse. Luckily, my son's nurse had happened to arrive at the same time, and all my, it was almost as if she actually thought I was having a stroke.
Really?
I literally felt nauseous. I thought, I didn't know whether I was going to vomit. I thought I was going to faint. My speech started to, I could hear my speech was blurred. I actually felt quite drunk. And then she observed that my face had started to, my eye and the side of my face had started to sort of droop a bit. And that's when she called the ambulance and she actually thought I was actually having a stroke. I was, luckily she was here, and between herself, the team in Jack and Jill, the team in St. Michael's House, who I'm indebted to, because without them, and I was in hospital for 6 nights, and then, but I was not in any, probably you could say, physical state to mind my son when he came home.
Mm.
One of the amazing ladies in St. Michael's House, she took him, she is a qualified nurse, and because my family and friends couldn't take him overnight because obviously his medication, his tube feeds. So you are really restricted to the amount of people that can help. People come and help me. And when I came out of hospital that time, I had so many amazing family and friends that had, you know, dinners, you know, groceries sorted out, all that. But again, they could help me, but there's not many people other than, you know, probably a nurse that could possibly take Jack for any length or period of time. You know, they could bring him for, people could bring him for a walk and the like. But so I was absolutely indebted to those two organisations. But this is the point, really. When it comes to carers, there is nobody knocking on our door offering support.
Mm.
And I've heard so many stories about carers. You know, they may not have actually collapsed as I did, but you're hanging on a thread in some cases.
Yeah.
We need respite. We need breaks. And that sometimes a couple of hours a day, it's a block of time. It's 48 hours that you can actually have 2 nights of sleep. You don't have to sleep with one eye open. You don't have to constantly be on alert.
Mm.
And that's
just to have that that kind of deep sleep, just to relax. Nina, you didn't have a stroke, did you?
No, well, in actual fact, it was, they thought I had this I can't even remember the name, a mini stroke. These things happen so quick, they can't actually say whether you did or didn't. It was confirmed to me that the MRI and CT scans were all absolutely clear based on my age and my medical history. I didn't fit the stroke bill, you know, a list of questions. They said you don't typically fit it. But like that, because these mini strokes can happen so fast, you know, they said, we don't know, but all we can say is now everything is okay. So, but my I wasn't even that. I didn't know at the time. I was complaining in the hospital. Whilst the stroke team were there, I was complaining about pains in my shoulder, my neck, my wrist. And I had some MRI scans when I was there. They identified I do have, I need surgery on my wrist now for a wrist complaint. I also had a problem with an injury to my shoulder. These are things that I was just carrying
around. You didn't notice them.
I knew I was
them.
In pain.
Jeez.
Because the nights that Jack slept, I would be awake with horrible nerve pain in my wrist, which would keep me awake for hours. And my shoulder, I was stroking my shoulder as well, complaining of the pain. But as a carer, you just keep going.
Yeah.
You don't have, you don't, you can't take the time out. In a lot of cases, you either don't notice you're in pain, or you think, I don't have time to go for treatment or for physio or anything like that. And I'm awaiting surgery now. My wrist was supposed to happen in January, but of course, the pandemic was cancelled. And I remember when the surgeon said, "No, we do need to do surgery on that." And I thought, I looked in panic, going, "What?" Mm. Like, because I said, I acknowledged that obviously having my son and his needs. He said, "No, you will need support afterwards because you will not be able to use that wrist or that your right arm for the 4 weeks afterwards." But this is the thing: a lot of carers put things off because their first thoughts are in relation to the child that they're caring for, or in my case, it's the child, the person they are caring for, and they sort of put their own needs second. You know, so that is quite normal for.
So you must have been on adrenaline, just living on adrenaline, and that's how that was keeping you going. And then you just hit that wall and it's just pure exhaustion. And like, it's going to happen again, Ina, if you're not getting... We've just got a text in, Ina, saying, asking, can you get a break to have respite? And that's Leslie and Sharon who are listening in. As you're saying, it's very hard for the carer to have respite, the carer of a child or an adult even, to have that break. But you need it. You're not a robot. You're a human being. So you need to have a break to... even just to sleep, those few days away.
And it is, and in fairness, I've always said credit to Jack and Jill, the Good Jack and Jill Foundation, because the nurses come here and they could be here for half a day or a day. But again, it sometimes you just need a bit more than that. You do need the overnight sleep. Mm. And it's something that, like, Jack and Jill, they're a charity. They provide funding for to help families like mine for a child at the age of six. My son Jack will be six next February. And then they unfortunately are leaving our life then, but you think, what will be in place at that stage? Mm-hmm. But you know, there are so many battles that carers have. I'm here talking about respite. You know, people I know have battles with getting adequate equipment for their child or for somebody in their family. I've heard so many cases of people been on waiting lists for different things, and we need these things to keep ourselves going. Mm-hmm. Like, we have enough going on with our job, this job that is, you know, the relentless 24/7 job, we're managing feelings of sadness, grief, frustration, and we are still having to find the time to write letters, to make phone calls, to beg for different things. Mm-hmm. You know, I even recall my son even starting preschool. These are things that people take for granted. I had a desperate battle get my son into a preschool that was suitable for his needs. And, you know, there's so many, it's all down to numbers again.
Our
children cannot go to your typical preschool. And, you know, my son didn't have the correct label to get into the preschool I had applied for. And when I talk about labels, he has this huge big label, this name of his condition is Oberkleindienst syndrome. But, like, that breaks down to the fact that he doesn't, you know, obviously he's tube-fed, he has a heart complaint, he's no vision in one eye, he has so many things going on. So he's loads of different things, but sometimes it's not having a label, it's having the correct label.
Yeah.
And, you know, different services say, well, your child can come here, but they have to have this, or okay, they have to have that. And our children, they have multiple disabilities. Mm. They don't necessarily fit. It's like trying to get a square peg into a round hole, and they don't necessarily fit into one place. And this is the problem that a lot of parents that our carers are facing is, oh, we've all these labels, but we might not have the correct label for that particular service that you're looking for.
It's a disgrace. I mean, as I said, I did an interview a couple of weeks ago with David Butler, and he is trying to get a mobility transport in a wheelchair for his son Bear. That's his right to be able to go to school, but as it is as well, like, he's stuck in a remote place that hasn't got any national transport, so he can't. Now, every child has a right to go to school, to go to preschool, and you shouldn't have to fight for this. It seems it's just a disgrace. And your son was...
And our children. Sorry, I was going to say, our children, they already are, have such a disadvantage already. Mm. Their lives are difficult enough. Carers, we have enough battles going on. Like, these doors, you would think, should be opened for us.
Yeah.
You know, we should be spending our time. Like, I've been writing letters to my son, trying to get him, particularly that preschool battler or whatever it might be. You're doing this at 11 and 12 at night when your children are asleep in bed. So you really don't have downtime to be relaxing, because you're trying to fit in your housework, you're trying to fit in your grocery shopping. You know, all these things have to fit in around your child. So again, you can only do that for so long before you hit that wall, which I discovered.
You did,
But, you know, being honest, the children with the highest or the most needs, they're expected to be waiting longer in some cases than other people, because they can't talk, they can't shout. Well, sorry, my son is nonverbal. And it's just very hard and frustrating for the parents. We are their voice, but, you know, I'm one voice, but there's thousands of voices.
But you shouldn't have to, Anina, you shouldn't have to be fighting for these things. These things should be coming to you and say, this is what you're entitled to, this is what you should be doing, this is what, how you can get it. Instead of you having to, like, as you said, your day is looking after your son, and then on top of that, trying to fight for what he's entitled to. It shouldn't be that way. Now, you said he was diagnosed with Obercleid-Danck syndrome. I've never heard of it, so it's very rare disease, is it?
Oh, it's extremely rare. I, being honest, even the doctors, nobody really knew what was wrong with him, and that's why it took so long to diagnose him. This condition, I think there's only approximately, I've read different reports, 40 cases in the world, 50 cases in the world. So, yes, it is extremely rare. So there's no one else in the country that I know that has this condition. And even for his medical team, treating him, well, they've never had another child with this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it is, and it's quite lonely that I can't go and swap stories with another parent has this condition. But the job as a special needs parent is quite lonely. You know, like, a lot of my fellow mums that were pregnant at the same time as me, their kids are now in junior infants. They're walking, talking, eating. They're doing a lot of the things that my son is still struggling to do or not doing. And you look and think, my God, life could have been very different, if he didn't have this. Yeah.
As you said, you're grieving the life that you probably should have had. And I know you love Jack, of course you do, you'd never change your life. But you're probably grieving the life that you wanted to see him going to school and doing, well, you know, the normal things in life.
Exactly, exactly. You know, like, so I look at other children and think, will my son ever be able to do that? Mm. I always use an analogy that I'd love if we went to McDonald's and he ran in through the door and he just asked me, could he have chicken nuggets and chips?
I know.
So then I know that he's eating, he's talking. You know, these things that parents take, I don't know,
granted.
We all assume these are things.
Human beings,
these are absolute basics. That, and we haven't even got to the stage of wanting your child to dress themselves and all these other things. But, you know, eating is a basic thing that we want your child to do. And every single, like thinking about birthdays, Christmas, Easter, all these big events in our lives, they all revolve around larger and eating. And that is a big struggle that I have, that even my son's birthday, and he doesn't know, he's an intellectual disability, he has no idea it's his birthday, but we still make a cake. We still go through the charade.
Christmas.
He has no clue about Santa Claus. But we go through this because we feel we have to. We try to be normal. We try to do everything normal. But in actual fact, it actually can be these events, and I'm sure I'm speaking on behalf of many parents of kids with special needs, that may not, sometimes they can be very difficult and a struggle. And we just do them more too because we feel we have to fit in, to feel normal. Feeling normal is a feeling that so many parents I know, they just, you just want to feel normal.
So Jack is 5 years old now. Is he saying any words, or is he walking little bit, or playing? What can he do?
There's no words. No words at all. Last year in the pandemic was amazing. He started to walk with the aid of his little green walking friend. That was amazing. And he's flies around on that. And then in recent months, he started to take steps independently.
Brilliant.
That was very exciting, because this was something I was thinking, oh my God. Now, I can only describe him as being like a nervous toddler. Like he wouldn't be, everywhere we go, he's either in a buggy, he's on his walking frame, because he can't, I couldn't just get him, he can't just jump out of the car and walk into a shop with me, you know. So yeah. We're not at that stage. But certainly it gives me hope to think that in the future, we might get there. Mm-hmm. Now, nobody knows. Mm-hmm. Would he need a frame or a buggy long term? I don't know. And nobody can tell me that one day he'll be, you know, skipping and jumping and running around. I don't know. But it's very slow. It's watching all these the changes. Mm-hmm. Like he has both of his arms are fused at the elbows. We struggle to hold things, and that's something that can never be fixed. And but again, it's like that, we have to learn to live with that, and you know, things will be adapted possibly for him because he can't, you know, hold. Let's say, for example, he can't turn his hand around to hold change or anything in the palm of his hand. Yeah. That will be an action that he'll never be able to do. So. He will always have challenges, and I just hope that over time, some of the challenges get less difficult.
Hopefully.
So, but again, we don't know. You know, I've always been told, wait and see. I've been in that mode for 5 years now, and as a parent with a child with special needs, we often just sit there and we don't know what the future will be for us. We have to wait and see.
And I suppose you have to, you know, just take it day by day, because if you think too far ahead, you'd end up going insane. You know, you'd say, oh my God, like, you know, he's going to get older and you're going to get older. And do you ever think that far ahead? Like, if something should happen to you, what will happen to Jack?
Well, I did. Certainly in the first year, I couldn't stop thinking about the future, what the future would be like. And when I got his diagnosis, it was actually almost like a life sentence, because isn't just for his life, but also for my life. Mm. And all those hopes and dreams you have for your child, whether it be, you know, graduate from school, graduate from college, get married, have kids, go travelling, like, they just disappeared overnight. And these are the natural feelings that people would have. They just disappeared overnight. And then I had to stop thinking about what the future might be like because it was just too sad. Mm. And now I just focus on this moment.
Yeah.
You know, and I've picked up the concept of living in the now. I have learned that in the last few years because I can't think beyond this moment. Mm. And for me this year, Jack got one of four places in St. Michael's House School in Balldoyle, and I was absolutely overjoyed. That has been the highlight, the best day of this year for me so far, is finding out that news. And at least I think, okay, that's school sorted.
Yeah.
And I said, there's certain things I can't think beyond that. Okay, we had a school place. And I'm so happy he's going to that school. I've heard just amazing things about it. And I'm just so happy. I'm so grateful that he got that place. And at least I can say, okay, that's one thing I don't have to worry about. Mm. But, there's so many other dreams and hopes I would have had for my son that you don't know, will they ever happen?
They might. Yeah. Well, Nina, as you said, you just have to take it day by day. And, you know, with the research going on, and I know there's nobody else in Ireland that has this, which is very sad, because it'd be great if you could be in touch with other people going through what you're going through, at least even to talk to somebody else about, you know, how you're feeling, and, you know, I suppose discuss different symptoms. Have you been in touch with anyone else around the world that has a child with this?
Do you know, actually, I even joined a Facebook group for the exact condition, but some of the stories are very tragic.
Okay.
The mortality rate with Jack's condition is about 40-50%. And I was reading stories of children dying, and I just stopped. I said, you know, I'm happy in my own little world, and I'm going to focus on this.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have an amazing, amazing group of other mums of children with special needs around me. And that's one thing I will say, and I've said it to people, that if you have a child that's born with a condition, no matter what it is, surround yourself with other people. It's almost like your own village. And I have learned more from this group of mums around me than I will have probably learned from, you know, doctors over the years, but just more from a supportive point of view.
Mm.
We're all walking the walk together.
Exactly.
We get each other. We understand. We all live in the same world. And we just get it. We can laugh. We can laugh about things that are going on in our world that people, just other people, wouldn't get. And they have been my absolute lifeline. I would have been lost without this group of mums around me, 100%.
But what you're saying today, the point you want to get out there today is, who cares for the carers? You need to have a break, and you should be entitled to have a day or two out just to even sleep. You need a break.
Yeah, long-term respite, really. Yeah. As I said, Jack and Jill provide an amazing service up to the child's age of six. But that's another thing. I think long-term, how is this going to pan out for Jack, for me, you know, in relation to, I'd love, I had a career. I often look back and think, my God, it seems like a long time ago.
Yeah.
Could I ever go back to doing something long-term for me that's not just a little bit of something here and a little bit of something there, something that's meaningful that I can say, you know, for me, at the moment, my life revolves around Jack
yeah.
and his needs. But and carers, yes, we need a break, knowing that this will be the way, you know, respite ongoing for many years, whether that means just once a month for a night or two nights, but just sometimes that you can actually look forward to.
Yeah.
Because other than that, you are like just, you're almost like in one of these little, you know, a mouse going around one of these wheels. Mm. And you just don't stop to, like what happened to me last summer, I fell off it.
Exactly. And you don't want that to happen again. And you're not, you're a human being. You need to have something to look forward to. You need rest. You need that break. Even, as you said, one or two nights a month, even just for something to look forward to. And I know, Jack, he's the best thing that's happened to you. And you wouldn't change a thing. But I mean, you do need help. And listen to your story today. I hope there's people listening in and saying to themselves, like, you know, we really need to get this sorted here in Ireland. I mean, you're not the first person I've spoken to with a child that has special needs. And everyone is saying the same story. They're fighting and fighting and fighting to try to get the help that they should be entitled to. And it's not on. It really isn't. But Nina, thanks a million for sharing your story today. And I hope Jack is doing well. And maybe you'll talk to us again in the future to let us know how he's doing.
Oh, absolutely, Debbie. Listen, thank you for listening to me today. I appreciate that.
Oh, you're very welcome, Nina. Mind yourself.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And there you go. What a lovely lady. And that's Nina, and talking about her son, Jack, who has a rare disease called Oberkleid-Dank syndrome. And what Nina is saying is the carers of children that have special needs need a break. You heard what happened to her last year when she hit that brick wall and thought she was having a stroke, ended up in hospital for 5 days, because sometimes carers are on their own, and she's on her own with her child, looking after him 24 hours a day. Jack doesn't sleep a normal night's sleep, so she could be up through the night, and he's peg fed. So it's an awful lot. And she's not a robot, she's a human being. And as I said, do listen, and hopefully things will change, that we don't have to fight and fight and fight for things that we're entitled to, and what our children are entitled to. And they're entitled to have a normal life, and Nina's entitled to have a life as well.